You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Tour de France, brought to you by iWoka, flexible loans built for small businesses. iWoka.co.uk. Today, we're in Villard-de-Lans.
What tram is that we're hearing in the background, Lionel?
Well, that will be the Grenoble tram, won't it? That's going round
the
town.
Nothing gets past you, eh?
No, no.
It's called
Where are we, Lionel?
It's called TAG.
Oh,
yeah. The tram of Grenoble. It's the transportation in Grenoble is called TAG.
Well, well, well. You learn something new every day with Francois. Every day is
well,
a school day.
Well, it's written on the tram, so I didn't have too much difficulty in finding out.
Well, here we are. We're definitely in the Alps now, aren't we?
We are, yeah, we are. Centre of Grenoble, where the stage starts tomorrow. Outside a bar in the centre of a square.
It starts outside a bar, just like the first ever Tour de France.
Well, I think it probably does, actually, because as I cycled my bicycle into town this afternoon, Richard, I came across where the stage start is being set up. Not far from our hotel, the Hotel de l'Angleterre.
Yeah, well, the stage will actually pass in front of the hotel. I hope we can get out of the hotel in the morning. We don't know. There might be bars everywhere and we're stuck. But we'll see.
The fact you mentioned your bike ride so early there, Lionel, suggests that you want to tell people about your bike ride today.
Well, I was going to do a little preamble tale of the etap. Because this morning, Richard, you rode from the hotel to the start. How far was it?
60 kilometres.
And then I rode from the start to the hotel in Grenoble, and it was 66 kilometres.
Oh, you win.
But I don't win because it was a beautiful route. I plotted into Komoot. First time I've actually used Komoot outside of England, actually. And you can choose on it, can't you, whether you're a serious cyclist or a... serious cyclist. And it sent me over every flaming climb between... there and here, and at one point I was going up something that was sort of 18%, and I thought, nah, forget this, turn the thing down, and it then sent me on a nice lovely road that went round a lake and then a beautiful 20 kilometers of cycle track into the city center. Here the only downside was didn't take me through any towns that were serving any lunch whatsoever. So
you had something emergency apple tart, didn't you?
I had an emergency apple tart.
Yeah,
at a
I'm told
roadside
that there was
boulangerie.
A great restaurant at the top of the 18% climb, and an even better descent for your skills. But never mind.
Yeah, well, never mind. I never found that out. But it was a lovely ride, and it was quite nice to get into the hotel and watch the last 50 kilometres. Of the race on the TV.
Well, my bike ride, Lionel, since we're sharing this, and it wasn't a super exciting stage, so we can be forgiven maybe for dwelling on this briefly, but I rode out from back over the climb. The cycling facilities around here are amazing. The cycle tracks around the lake. There was a cycle path through a tunnel, a kilometre and a half long, just up the other side of Aix-les-Bains that took me over into the next valley and alongside the Rhône, the river. And it's huge. And there was a cycle path along the river for about 20 kilometres. Absolutely beautiful. A few cyclists on it, not too many. And it's a very wide, kind of like the Mississippi almost, slow-moving river.
Oh, if it's the Rhône, yeah, it's the biggest river in France by far. Yeah.
Yeah, stunning. It was a stunning ride, actually.
What it does mean is that dinner cannot come soon enough because I had quite a light breakfast and then an apple tart at 4 o'clock, and that is it.
Let's get on with the podcast then, shall we? On with the racing.
Yeah.
What happened in the stage?
Well, stage 16 from La Tour du Pin to Villard-de-Lans. The first of the proper alpine stages, three in a row we have this week. I think that's right, isn't it? Mary Bell is definitely in the Alps, and then
yeah. Ossia Merlet was in the Alps already, but in the Southern Alps. But he's definitely in the Alps. But yeah, well, but now we enter the proper alpine section.
La Roche-sur-Yon, is that back in the Jura or
no? La Roche-sur-Foron is actually in the valley, just like that. But yeah, no, we're in the Alps for the next 3 days.
You're
don't worry.
I'm paranoid here. This is terrible.
I am.
Daniel's got you on edge.
Well, I mean, if it's not cappuccino drinking times or how to serve sauce on pasta, it's mountain ranges. Yeah,
well, I'm looking forward to.
We were actually in the Alps on day two. Because the Turini path, I mean, it's the Alps Maritimes, but it's Alps. So, yeah.
And I'm looking forward to Saturday's final alpine stage at La Planche des Belles Filles.
Anyway, after a few little skirmishes, a big break went. Richard Calapaz of Ineos Grenadiers kind of started it, and Nico Roach of Sunweb reacted, and then they were joined by another of the Ineos Grenadiers riders, Andre Amador. Then there was Leonard Kamna and Daniel Oss of Bora Hansgrohe. Julian Alaphilippe was in there. Sebastian Reichenbach of Groupama was in there. Alberto Bettiol of EF Pro Cycling. Anacona and Barguil of Arkea Samsic, Aviti and Verona of Movistar, Matteo Trentin, Chris Yule Jensen and Quentin Pacher of B&B Hotels. And that was the first phase of the break that went away. Matteo Trentin won the intermediate sprint, the fifth time he's done that in this tour.
Yeah.
He won the intermediate sprints on stages 2, 7, 10, 15 and 16.
Has he been told there's no jersey for doing that? You know, well, he used to be called Le Point Chaud in the 80s, you know?
He did, the red jersey. maybe... He's sneaking up on the green jersey without, you know, wanting to draw too much attention to himself, perhaps. We've asked our diarist, Simon Geschke, to explain CCC's tactics there. Anyway, Pierre Roland went across, as did Thijs Benoot and Casper Pedersen of Sunweb. And then finally, on the Col de Port, Nielsen Paulus, Pavel Sivakov, Roman Sikar, Mikko Nieve and Simon Geschke made it 23 riders out in front. By this point, Pierre Roland of B&B Hotels was out in front on his own. The gap to the peloton from the front to the peloton was about a quarter of an hour, so the stage was kind of done. Then there was a changing of the guard at the front and Pacher was out in front. And then finally, the move that decided the stage was Amador, Calapaz, Reichenbach, Kamna and Alaphilippe. And Kamna went away near the top of the final first category climb with about 18 kilometres to go. Calapaz tried to go with him but couldn't get up to the German. And so Kamna kind of did a Mark Hirschi with the ride, the strength of his ride to the finish. And after second place at Puy-Marie behind Danny Martinez a few days ago, he got Bora Hansgrohe's stage win. Calapaz second, Reichenbach third, and then two of our diarists in fourth and fifth, Sivakov and Geschke. The Roglic group came in at 16 minutes 48. The only real change to the top of the overall was Nairo Quintana lost a bit more time, and so Tom Dumoulin has overtaken him. We saw Egan Bernal dropped very early for him, and at the finish he said he's got a back problem, which we knew had hampered him at the Dauphiné. It's obviously still a problem, and now he says his knee is also painful, but he says he wants to finish the tour. The King of the Mountains is hotting up. Benoît Cosnefroy is still in the jersey, but Roland has drawn level on points after his exploits today. Pog is 2 points back, Rog is 3 points back, and Nan Peters, who took a point today, is 4 points back. That competition will probably really change tomorrow on the climb over the Madeleine and up to Méribel.
40 points on the last climb to the tomorrow. So in one climb, you win the Polkalo jersey. The guy who gets to the top there kind of gets back to the discussion we had yesterday about the, you know, in the press conference about the KOM. If actually the KOM jersey is decided on one climb, you know, on and one, you know, if there's a breakaway and somebody wins the stage, and you know, it's the first time he's in the standings, he can still win the jersey on one climb, which is a little bit strange, but that's the way it is.
Before I forget, Rich, just a couple of points of order. There were no positive COVID tests in the Tour de France bubble, so no positive tests at all. Jérôme Cousin of Total Direct Energy finished outside the time limit. It was very close as well for Cousin. And David Godu has abandoned the race as well. So there'll be no more waiting for Godu.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a small business, find out more at iwoca.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
So I'm Patrick Healy, and I'm the owner of Peak Ascent Cycles, which is a bike shop based in the Peak District. The bike business can be very seasonal. The big challenge I had was obviously expanding the range due to public demand, but more importantly, just having that cash flow to be able to bring in new stock. And that's where iWalker sort of ticked all the boxes for me. I was surprised how quick and easy it was, if I'm honest. What it enabled me to do was just strengthen my stock profile. Some of it went into just adding to that marketing experience through my website. It enabled me to do more than I was expecting initially.
Well, that was Patrick Healy from Peak Ascent Cycles, an iWalker customer. one of many who work in the cycling industry, actually, and it's one reason why Iwoka support us. They found that a lot of their customers were in the cycling industry, and there are a lot of cyclists at Iwoka. They're a very cycling-friendly company. They also, of course, sponsor the Kendal Cycle Club, as well as the Cycling Podcast. And thank you very much to Iwoka. If you want to find out more about how Iwoka can help you, if you run a small business, go to iwoka.co.uk, iwoca.co.uk. So today felt like a bit of a phony war before the big sort of, well, tomorrow's stage in particular, as regards GC. But another big breakaway, teams that are here not to win the Tour de France, but to try and win a stage. And finally, Bora Hansgrohe got their stage. And, you know, they deserve it because they are one of the teams who've really been trying and trying and trying again with different riders. And Leonard Kamna is a very talented young rider. I think I mentioned earlier, he really caught the eye during the Tour de France last year on one of the stages won by Simon Yates in the Pyrenees. He was very strong that day. Moved from Sunweb to Bora Hansgrohe, and
he rode the Sunweb way, in a way.
Yeah, he did a Sunweb today. But yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody could argue about Bora Hansgrohe's deservedness of that stage victory. And we're hoping to hear from our audio diarist Lucas Postelberger on what exactly happened, and that'll be in our audio diaries Kilometre Zero episode tomorrow. But yeah, very well taken stage, and particularly because I thought Richard Carapaz and, you know, Ineos Grenadier is obviously out for something today, out to prove a point. I spoke to one of their guys this morning who said that it was really difficult to switch from riding in support of a leader to trying to win stages. And, you know, Michał Kwiatkowski, you imagine, would want to try and win a stage, but it can be quite difficult to switch mentally and physically from riding one way to riding another way.
Mind you, Carapaz finished second, and Pavel Sivakov, I think, in the top 10 as well.
He was fourth, wasn't he?
Yeah, fifth, and Andre Amador was not far out either. So, I mean, they tried hard, and it also shows, like, maybe Kemna's victory also came at a moment when they finally decided not to defend Peter Sagan's green jersey chances, because he missed out on the only intermediate sprint of the day. So, well, you know, when they don't have these missions of defending their leaders, I mean, the great talents of some of those teammates, comes to light. And, Kemna, we knew about him. I suddenly remember one thing about him. Kemna that I'd read in the past seasons. He took a long break of several months, I think, two seasons ago, because he was still a young rider, but he kind of burnt out, or he felt, you know, he'd done too much, and he said it had been the right decision for him because he came rejuvenated. So there's a discussion about what, you know, the COVID crisis did to a training, and if for some riders it was not a great way to kind of taking a rest, and whether the coronavirus crisis may not explain why the riders are going so fast this year, because as we saw, you know, it's probably going to be one of the fastest tours ever. I mean, we don't have the figures yet, but I mean, we saw in the mountains everything. But Kemna, he did that before the COVID crisis. He had a kind of personal burnout. I mean, he didn't exactly explain what was wrong with him, but he came back stronger, and he's only 24, and another one of this generation of the Hirschis and all these kids, you know, taking over. And it was a great win.
One other thing about Kemna that just slight quirk is that when he was second in the under-23 road race at the World Championships in Bergen in 2017, he'd come out of the Vuelta, hadn't he? And there was a little bit of talk about, you know, should a rider who's just finished a Grand Tour or just ridden a Grand Tour, I'm not sure he finished, but he'd ridden a good chunk of a Grand Tour, should he be in the under-23 World Championships? Well, he was beaten in the sprint, two-man sprint at the finish by Benoît Cosnefroy, who's in the King of the Mountain jersey at the moment.
Well, behind him, Richard Carapaz actually looked the stronger on the climb. He's a very dynamic rider, isn't he, Carapaz? We haven't seen a lot of that at the Tour, but I find him a very exciting rider to watch, and I would have had him nailed on to win that stage. He's had a couple of crashes in this Tour, including one on Sunday, and as we keep talking about, these crashes do, you know, affect a rider's performance, and I don't think we've seen Carapaz at anything like his best here. But I thought he was, you know, looking good for the win. But Kamna, it was a real sort of opportunist move. Carapaz had been trying all the way up the climb to lose everybody. Yeah, he did a pretty good job of that. Couldn't quite lose Kamna. The minute he switched off, Kamna went, and that was it.
Yeah, he missed. I think Carapaz mistimed his attack in many ways because he was focusing on Alaphilippe, I suppose. And once Alaphilippe got dropped, he went on like Danny Martinez did at in the finale the other day, and thought it was it. You know, he was the fastest because Kamna had originally been dropped a little bit and came back. You know, at his own pace, not you know very steadily. At the very moment when when there was a kind of a lull just before tackling the descent, that's when Carapaz all of a sudden thought he probably had the job done, and that's when Kamna went. Down like once again another like Hirschi the other day. This young riders have understood all the benefits of descending well, and Kamna's win came in the descent much more so than in the climb.
I wonder how much it was playing on his mind that they'd had the two against one scenario against Danny Martinez the other day, and had been outwitted, outfoxed, outstrength. Danny Martinez was the best, wasn't he, that day, really? I mean, tactically, they didn't really make too much of a hash of it. I mean, Kamna's first, as I think I said on the day, Kamna's first attack was, he might as well have had balloons tied to his handlebars. I mean, it was so obvious what he was going to do. But this time he was in the underdog position a bit. You know, Ineos had Amador and Carapaz up there, and they could have made it difficult for him. And I think in those situations, from the outside, we look at it and think, well, you've got two riders. You really ought to be able to pin this down and win the stage. But actually, the pressure's off the individuals. The individual can just do what they want to do and not have to worry about, if somebody goes, who does what? Will somebody mark? I thought it was a victory à la pedale, wasn't it, though?
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Our Tour de France coverage this year is sponsored by the next generation Watt bike Atom.
That's right, and today we're going to hear from a professional athlete who is not a cyclist, but who loves the sport, does a lot of riding, and has fallen in love with the Watt bike Atom and incorporates it in his own training. It's someone you're very familiar with, Lionel, the Watford, former Manchester United and England goalkeeper, Ben Foster.
Absolutely, yeah.
This must be the best moment ever.
World colliding, Watford and the Cycling Podcast all together. Funnily enough, Ben Foster was featured in the Guardian newspaper a few days ago talking about his love of cycling and how when he retires as a footballer, he wants to go and tackle the great climbs of the Tour, the Giro and the Vuelta, and perhaps even ride Dirty Kanza. So let's hear from Ben Foster.
For me, running it's not even an option. I'm a big guy anyway. I'm 6'4", I'm 92 kilo. Running is just a problem for me. It'll aggravate stuff, it'll aggravate the bones, and very rarely do any running of any sort. All my fitness work is done on the Watt bike in the gym, and it suits me down to the ground. To be fair, even I can leave it sort of 2 days before a game. I know 2 days before a game is my cut-off point from when I can do any serious cycling, really. So during the week, I'm pretty much on the bike every day, whether it's in the gym doing a kind of a fat burning session, or whether it's at home on Zwift doing sort of a Crit City race or something like that. Can actually still clock up the mark. Like I say, I'm a goalkeeper, so luckily I haven't got to run around as much as the outfield players. So I can sort of get away with doing a lot more stuff than what they could do. That now, I've managed to actually rope quite a few of the players into it. I think lockdown was a big thing for cycling. A lot of players got on board. A lot of players were buying Watt bikes. They actually ended up buying road bikes as well, which was really nice to see. And it's carried on as well. Once we've got back to football after the lockdown, people have still been doing the work on the Watt bike because it's a really good thing for them to just keep their base fitness. It doesn't replicate for the outfield players doing the on-pitch work, but it does give you a really good base level of fitness.
The Watt Bike Atom is available now from £90 per month from wattbike.com. That's WATTBIKE.com.
Well, we didn't really need confirmation about Egan Bernal's form, did we, today? It was pretty obvious after Sunday that he's not in the sort of shape he was in at the Tour de France last year when he won it. He had another bad day today. There's something clearly wrong with him. And to try and sort of understand what that might be, and also how Team Ineos kind of cope with this situation, which is very new to them. In 2014, they lost Chris Froome to a crash. Richie Porte became their leader. But they're not used to being in the position that they're in now, which is going to the final week of the Tour de France without a chance of winning it. So I spoke to Dave Brailsford today. I managed to speak to him on the phone. He was at the finish. Here's what he said about Bernal and the effect it's had on the team. Going into Sunday's stage, Egan looked really well positioned, better than last year, in fact, closer to the yellow jersey. And I think everybody thought that in the third week we'd see the best of him. So what was your reaction when you saw him begin to struggle and then lose contact with the group?
As soon as the stage started, actually, going into the very first climb, he said that he was really struggling. By the time he got to the end of the stage, it was no surprise. That part didn't come as a surprise, as I knew there was something clearly wrong. It wasn't going to be his day, basically. I guess it was unexpected, I must say. Haven't really seen that for a long time. And ever since we started watching him, early in his under-23 career, through his under-23, into his first couple of years pro and into our team, we never really seen him have a bad day like that, really. So it makes me feel like there's something more to it than just a bad day, I think. So I'm sure we'll get to the bottom of it in due course.
Any health issues? Is he feeling okay other than on the bike?
He felt he just felt completely empty. And the day before he felt okay. The day before that, obviously, at the top of the, when he lost some time on the climb, he was fine up to the first hairpin. Didn't really sustain the power he'd expect to, or we'd expect in the second half, which was, an underperformance, I think, in terms of what you'd normally expect. But I think that happens. You have good days and bad days, but the sort of the margins between the two aren't that big, really. But that obviously the performance was a really big kind of sort of way out in terms of what we'd have expected and he expected, actually.
I spoke to you at the start of the tour about, how you were reflecting on how young he is, and it's quite remarkable that he is already a Tour de France winner. How is he? Is he pragmatic about that? That he's still learning.
I'd lie if I didn't say that I was very mindful about that. In terms of, he is only 23. He's won the Tour de France at a very, very young age, and of course in a country that's never won it before. And so from his sort of the reaction of his home in Colombia and all the Colombians towards him last year, and then going in with a weight of expectation this year, it's a lot to shoulder. And I think over the years, both in the Tour and in the Olympics, you don't very often see the first time winner come back and repeat that in the second consecutive year. And also, quite often in the Olympics, we saw athletes who reached the goal of a gold medal in the Olympics for the first time, and then struggled a little bit to back it up straight away after that. So it's not unexpected. And I guess my concern is that at 23. What you don't want is somebody to kind of grow up too quickly, as it were, and miss all of those sort of early, those younger years. And the world that we've chosen to live in elite sport has got, you've got very, very high, it's like a roller coaster, very, very high highs. But equally, in order to get those high highs, you've got to accept that there's going to be some real low. I think you've got to learn, and I think all the great champions, they learn to win, but equally they learn to lose and how to respond to that. And I think that's what he's having to do now.
And how about you? It's an unusual experience for you, I guess, as well. I remember 2014, after Chris Froome had crashed out, it was maybe similar in a way, but that's quite a long time ago. It must be odd being in the final week of the tour and not being in the position that you're used to being in.
It is, but I think I'm a very different person now, maybe, and we're further forward than I was in 2014. And, of course, we went, then Richie picked up the baton, as it were, and didn't quite work out for him on Chamrousse. And that was, that was tough. That was a tough year. Obviously we have, in the 11 sort of times we tried to win the tour, we've won it way more than we've lost. And we come here in more recent years trying to sustain winning, and sort of not losing, as it were, rather than being the challenger and stepping up and going to try and win. And I guess, as of the day before yesterday, we're now in that position where we're now the challengers again. So I think you can put it into context, really. And I think we're all very, very motivated and buoyed by the fact that, next year's tour starts here. And we got the last week of the tour to really think about, what can we do in this last week? To get into last week of the Tour de France with an opportunity of saying, okay, can we try something different nutritionally? Can we try, various kind of things that you'd never really risk in a normal tour. Let's use the opportunity now and experiment a little bit and see what we can learn and start thinking about next year already and build that project and get on a mission for next year. So I think that's the positive way of dealing with it.
We saw Bernal at the end of the, you know, at the end of the peloton, stretching and everything. It seems obvious that the back is the issue. But he had a kind of a smile on his face, and he said during the rest day he was going to try, to play the role of a domestique and go to the car and take the musettes and stuff, and he did actually, as we saw that on TV, and he, you know, so well maybe I don't know if it's of his own initiative or if it's the advice from the team, but he's kind of trying to see what the others are doing for him in the rest of it. I mean, he never had that kind of experience, and so maybe they're trying to make it a learning last week of the tour for Bernal to realize that, you know, what the other guys do for him the rest of the year, and probably can sometimes boost this kind of experience, the kind of team spirit within a team. So and he seemed to be doing it very lightheartedly.
Sometimes in defeat, reputations are enhanced, aren't they? People show their true colors, show their true selves in defeat. And you know, a few people commented on the fact that when Bernal lost the Tour de France on Sunday and cracked and lost 7 minutes, he stopped at the finish and spoke for a long time to journalists, which he didn't need to do, and that showed real kind of class, I think. I mean, I asked Brailsford about Bernal as well, and he just said he's very honest and he feels that he always has to tell people exactly what's going on. He doesn't want to sort of hide away. He wants to explain as well as he can what's going on. But yeah, I think he's come out of this with great credit, and I do sort of, you know, it almost just occurred to me last night as I was speaking, there's a helicopter. It almost just occurred to me last night as I was speaking that, remembering the great Francois Thomazeau's line about Tour de France winners are time trialists who can climb. Certainly multiple Tour de France winners, and Daniel talks a lot about dynasties, doesn't he? And when a 22-year-old wins the Tour, you tend to assume that's the start of a dynasty just because he's very young, as we did with Jan Ullrich. There are more factors at play. I mean, we're just coming out of the Chris Froome dynasty. The dynasty before that was really the Lance Armstrong dynasty. Contador, maybe, Lance Armstrong, Indurain, LeMond, Eno. But what is it that makes a multiple Grand Tour winner? You can have several years where the sport is still kind of searching for that dominant champion. And I don't think, well, unless it's Pogacar, you know, I don't think Roglic is going to win multiple tours just because of his age. He might win another one, but I don't think he's going to win multiple ones. I don't think he's going to come back year after year and be the boss. I don't know who that will be, but it only sort of occurred to me in the last sort of 24, 40 years that it might not be Bernal, you know, and it might not be Team Ineos.
Maybe another point to make is that back injuries, as we saw with Pinot and Bernal, are especially painful when you climb. You know, when you get up on the pedals and put yourself in the danseuse position, as we say, and that's when it really hurts. And so climbers are much more affected by back pains and after crashes than any other normal riders. So the Bernal issue, as the Pinot issue, I mean, their downfalls look all the more spectacular, as it is nearly impossible to climb properly with a back problem.
It's hard to avoid the question that Brailsford got the team selection wrong. I mean, you know, it was all for Bernal, which you logically would say, well, that's fine. But the pattern of Team Sky, Team Ineos over recent years has been to always have a second prong. Some, you know, last year it was Bernal and Thomas. Before that, it was Thomas and Froome. You know, even right at the beginning, it was Froome and Wiggins. And, you know, the strength of that position is, well, it, one props up the other. I'm not saying that...
Was it, though? I mean, okay, in 2013, it was Froome and Port. But 15, 16, 17, there wasn't... It was all for Froome.
Well, yeah. I mean, he was by then, a multiple tour winner. I just suppose... We thought when they put Carapaz in at very late notice, no one was expecting Carapaz to ride the Tour, were they? We think at the expense of a direct swap with Geraint Thomas. It's just a question. It's would they have been better off with Geraint Thomas here? I don't know. I mean, he's had a reasonable week at the Tirreno Adriatico. I'm not comparing the two races at all. It, for a start, Tirreno started a week later than the Tour did. Maybe, as you said, Richard, you know, the kind of he needed to sort of back off again before coming up to a level. And of course, his objective has completely changed because he's now going to the Giro. But they've Ineos have not looked right really from the start. And so when, nothing they had or nothing they could have done would have propped Bernal up with a back problem. So it's kind of irrelevant, but it does leave them in that position, a very alien position for them, where now they have to try and salvage something from the Tour.
Yeah, we kind of fooled ourselves, you know, when the team was announced, into believing that Carapaz and Sivakov could be number two and number three. And you know, but they both crashes, to be honest. They both crashed, to be honest. And secondly, I think that it's always easy now to say this, but maybe someone like Thomas, even in ill form, would have brought his experience. Look at what Dumoulin is doing. You know, he's doing a lot of good for Jumbo-Visma, riding as a teammate or Hesink, you know. And maybe the problem with this team in EOS this year is that it's too inexperienced and maybe too patchy.
Sivakov is an interesting one. He might be the guy. He might be the guy because he is in that mold of being a kind of bigger, more robust rider. He had terrible bad luck here, but his ride at the Giro last year, Tour of Poland, Tour of the Alps, his performances last year suggested to me that he has everything in his toolkit to become a Grand Tour contender.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for supporting us on the Cycling Podcast. Lionel, you wouldn't have needed that apple tart if you'd had your Science of Sport products
well,
with you.
Do you know, I did the whole check and realized that I'd left the little box of your Science of Sport products.
They're for me.
They are for you. And I thought, I'm going to nick one of those.
That's my secret stash.
One or two of those. And then I forgot. I mean, they weren't mine to take.
The orange cake bakes always serve
me
well.
Yeah, they weren't mine to take.
I snaffled one of them as I rode alongside the Rhone.
I was absolutely cursing you for not sharing as I was climbing up the umpteenth hill on the way to, well, from there to here. But yeah, it would have saved me.
Don't be like Lionel. Stock up with your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code Francois
SICP25.
There we go.
A little flourish as the Tour reaches its conclusion.
Important announcement. Tomorrow, Wednesday, September the 16th, the second batch of Stacey Snyder's Cycling Podcast mugs, cups, cappuccino sets, and beer cups.
Whoa.
A new development. Go on sale at 3 p.m. French time, 2 p.m. UK time, and 9 a.m. US East Coast time. Go to etsy.com/shop/Snyder Ceramics. We'll include details, the link to that, in the show notes as well. These always sell out within minutes, and they raise money. All the money goes to good causes, and the good causes during this Tour de France are the Joyriders in London, who help women discover cycling. It's particularly women from a Muslim background, help them into cycling and organize group rides and so on. And the Pichun, a group in Bagatelle in Toulouse, very deprived part of Toulouse, where kids are given the opportunity to actually learn about sports journalism. And every year at the Tour de France, there's a group of young kids from the Pichun. They make radio programs and they make a magazine. And I spoke to them last week. I think it was last week, maybe even the week before. I can't remember now. It's all kind of getting mixed up together. But I spoke to them. The guy I spoke to actually wouldn't tell me his name because he was one of their leaders. And he did not want any attention. He didn't want any of the limelight. He said, it's about the kids. So I don't want you to tell you my name, even, which is fair enough. And but he spoke good English, and he explained what they're all about. And but before we hear from him, let's hear from some of the Pichun themselves, four or five of the young kids who were there making a radio program as I sat and waited to interview them.
Malo.
Jade.
Salomé.
My name is Rasoul.
The kids, it's been like 10 years that they are coming to see the tour. In the beginning, it was just for one day. And then after several years, they were doing all the tour. And they were asking all the time, like, why the tour is passing all across France, but not in our district, which is a working class district. Everyone has different answers. In 10 years, they gained the tour at the bottom of the buildings. ISO, who's organizing Tour de France, they choose Toulouse. And they said, okay, the tour is gonna pass in Toulouse only if we go to Bagatelle, which is the district of the Pitchouns. That's a big achievement.
That was last year. And I saw you just recording just now. Is that a radio show that you record every day?
Exactly, that's a radio show, because this year with the COVID, we couldn't go interview people with the camera and all the stuff that they were all the years before. So we had to imagine something new to stay around the tour, but not around people with social distancing. So we thought about a radio station that goes all around with the tour. But the thing is that they have school. Tomorrow, we're still on the tour, but they're missing school just for one day, and they go to school the next day. We are coming back this weekend.
So a reminder that if you buy one of Stacey's beautiful cups, mugs, or beer cups, then you will help the Pitchoun and the Joyriders in London. Yeah, they're very appreciative, and they've really sort of engaged on social media and stuff. There's one of the beer cups, Lionel. What do you think about that?
Wonderful. Oh, fantastic.
Would you like that?
Yes. Oh, yes.
What do you think, Francois?
Oh, yeah, they look good, you know. I love the ones, maybe Stacey could make some in the future, the ones with the little lids, you know, on top of them.
Oh,
it would be nice. Yeah.
She can do anything.
I'm sure she would.
Also a reminder that Stacey is making a special one-off Pedler de Charme cup for the overall Pedler de Charme at this Tour de France. We haven't had many nominations, actually, but please send in your nominations. Egan Bernal almost qualifies for, you know, the way that he has handled his defeat with such grace, and, you know, going back and getting bottles and so on. I'm not suggesting that he should win it, but if you have a nomination for a Pedler de Charme, let us know on social media or email us contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. Now, somebody else I spoke to this morning at the start was Rod Ellingworth. I saw him deep in conversation with Matt Winston, the team Sunweb coach. They know each other very well, of course. I think Rod was congratulating him on having had a really successful tour, two stage wins, and they were up there again today on a stage that meant a lot to Nicholas Roach, one of the riders in the breakaway. His father sort of laid the foundations for his Tour de France win in 87 here on a stage. I've written about this stage in my book, Etape, because it was a real, doing over of Jean-Francois Bernard. You must have been here.
I was there, yeah.
Bernard, he punctured, then they attacked him through the feed zone, and it was a concerted thing. It was organized between Laurent Fignon,
Charlie Motte, Stephen Roach, and because they didn't like the Jeff Bernard. I mean, he was a bit of a brat in his day. He was kind of the same generation as the young guns we see on this Tour de France, but whereas they are likable. Jeff was a very likable guy actually now, and is a good friend of mine. But to be honest, in 1987, he was a bit of a prat.
Well, it didn't help that the previous year, Bernard Tapie, he was a sort of chosen son, wasn't he? And he promised him a Porsche if he won a stage, which he did. So he's probably driving around in his Porsche, not endearing himself to his colleagues.
In 1987, he was especially impressive in the Ventoux, Bernard. You know, he won the time trial there. Looked like the possible winner of the tour and successor to Bernard Hinault. But well, as you say, nobody wanted that. You know, he was really kind of hated by the whole peloton and all of the, not the old guard, because the other guys were not so old, but the older guys decided this young kid should be taught a lesson. And that's what he did, you know.
There were stories about them having the maps out on the bonnets of the team cars. You know, these were the days before team buses and Veloviewer and all the, you know, Garmins and all the rest of it. This was old school. they had the maps out and they were working out where the best place to attack him would be, and it was, well, it happened to be in the feed zone. Probably didn't need maps for that. Anyway,
maybe a little remark about the fact that you talked to Rob Ellingworth and Matt Winston, and I'm reading everywhere that it's the end of an era for British cycling, you know, with Chris Froome probably nearing retiring and Geraint Thomas and all these guys.
Froome's actually got another 5 years.
Yeah, but actually
another 10 years.
But actually, you know better than I do. There are up and coming young talent from Britain. But in this, but what's happening as well is there is the coaching talent is kind of spreading throughout the peloton now, and the guys who started maybe with Team Sky and with British Cycling are now in various teams, and so the influence of the of British Cycling over the last decade is kind of spreading over the peloton, and for the better.
Well, as I say, I spoke to Rod Ellingworth, his team Bahrain McLaren. It's interesting because all their eggs are in one basket. It's the Mika Landa basket, where some way have kind of spread the risk a bit. But they're all in for Landa and GC. And Landa's looked pretty good. He's still got an outside chance at the podium. It's a big last few days for them. And I spoke to Rod about his first Tour de France as the main man, the boss.
How's it going? Your first tour in charge?
Yeah, quite enjoying it, actually, yeah. Yeah, no, quite enjoying the challenge, you know. It's certainly a different role to what I've played in the past. You know, when I think about what I was doing in the past in the old team was totally different to this, you know. But I'm really enjoying it, and I'm sort of looking forward to this final week, really, you know. I'm normally absolutely knackered at this point, and I'm not knackered, so it makes a total difference to me, yeah. You know.
Mikael looks like he's in, you know, one of the best, strongest climbers here. How much was he affected by his crash? And obviously, you pretty much lost Wout Poels really as a useful ally for him.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you look at the team makeup, you know, firstly with Mikel, the crash hasn't affected him now. You know, I think there was that first couple of days, you know, you get your normal, but he was okay. I didn't think we didn't have any concern with him, to be honest. I think, yes, he's proving to be one of the better climbers, but unfortunately, you know, there was that loss of time on stage 7, and we as a whole team were really paying the price now. You know, I still think he can come on the podium if we get it right, you know, and if he really gets this next few days right, I don't see why he couldn't get on the podium, but it'll be a challenge, you know. But there's one thing for sure, he's going to fight. He's really up for it. He's feeling good this morning. But, you know, to be honest with you, it's not the climbing, is it? It's all the other stuff that goes off. And as we can see with Bardet, with Monument, you know, it's at them moments where it can be quite hard. But I think then behind, you know, Wout hasn't been at his best since his crash. And we lost Rafa Vals. But, you know, when you're in a position you're not leading, you're following anyway. And it's just about the team setting the guys up for the climbs. You know, it is what it is. But, yeah, the rest of the guys, Damiano, fantastic. Peo, fantastic. You know, the rest of them all doing a superb job, to be honest.
And I saw you, Rod, chatting to Matt Winston there, a guy you know well. And, yeah, it's really interesting because some teams come here with GC ambitions like your own.
Yeah.
And they've come with something, a completely different kind of set of objectives. It's interesting the way different teams approach this race, and it's made it an interesting race.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, you look at the green jersey fight, and that's changing the GC riding as well, isn't it? Because everybody's having to consider how the green jersey's getting played out on the road, and then you've got teams like Sunweb and Winston who are, you know, doing a brilliant job, you know, with a young team, isn't it? You know, I mean, again, hats off to Matt. I think for him to step up to being lead DS in the Tour de France. From when we first started all working together in British Cycling a few years back, you know, I think well done to him. Yeah, absolutely. He's done a great job.
You say there, Rich, that Mikael Landa's got an outside shot at the podium. I'll take that because he's quite a way down on Rigoberto Urán as it stands. But the stage tomorrow to Méribel, I guess, is the queen stage of this Tour de France because it goes over the Madeleine and up to Méribel, a new climb, the Col de la Loze, which is a cycle path, effectively. Really interested to see that and how it's raced and what it looks like. Landa's going to have to do something. You know, he can't just...
He's going to have to go forwards, isn't he?
He's going to have to ride faster than the other riders in order to overtake them in the GC.
He's going to have to pedal pretty hard.
But I wonder, you know, that's the sort of thing that could make tomorrow quite interesting. And I think today's kind of, you described it as a phony war. I mean, it wasn't even a phony war, was it? They didn't even pick up their pea shooters today, the GC riders. They just rode in. Well, they did.
Riders love it when you say things like that.
There was no...
they don't they?
I'm not, again, not saying it wasn't difficult, not saying the terrain wasn't hard, not saying they didn't go really fast, but there was no actual action to go no. well.
Well, Miguel Angel Lopez, we saw he's in top shape. I mean, it was one of your bets for the podium in Paris, and again in the finale, he attacked. Well, it didn't amount to much, but at least it showed that he still got a little bit of juice left. And
But tomorrow will be a different story, surely, on the climb to Méribel. It's a much harder climb. They'll have gone over the Madeleine before it.
The highest summit in the Tour this year. Yeah.
Somebody might crack. Somebody might go forward more quickly than one of the other riders. I mean, come on. Bloody hell, Richard. We can't reduce it down to
I mean, credits to...
Insight. Hashtag insight.
Credits to Landa is I looked at, because it struck me that there's been a reshuffle. I mean, some of the leading contenders in last year's Tour were obviously not here. But if you look at the GC from the last Tour and the GC from this year's Tour, there are very few names that I think there's only six in the top 15 that were in the top 15 last year, and among them. And credits to their consistency. Landa is always a fixture, whatever we think and whatever with the kind of reservations we can have about him, is always there in the top five, top six, top seven. So I mean, Rigo Urán is also there. So these are the guys who for the past Tour de France have always been consistent, and that's important in cycling as well.
We need to see Per Agud Landa, don't we? When he rode on the front, looking upwards, very demure looking.
Free Landa. Yeah. Now he's free. Let's see what he can do.
It's a little bit like Richie Porte. I mean, we see the best Richie Porte and the best Landa for many seasons, actually, on this Tour.
The only problem for them is that Team Jumbo-Visma will have six riders at the bottom of the final climb.
I want to read out a tweet just now from Mark Potter. Dilemma for Pogacar. If he wins a Tour, does he share the winnings with the team that helped him win, Jumbo-Visma? I mean, that's a fair point. Anyway, we should wrap things up. Big stage tomorrow. We're looking forward to that. And, there's still a lot of guys, Richie Porte, Miguel Angel Lopez, Rigoberto Urán, Mikel Landa. They all look in good nick. And I don't think this race is over. So let's anticipate that. Before we go, some thank yous to some friends of the podcast. From me, a big thank you to Justin Dawkins, Mr. W.J. Rieke, Liam O'Toole, Robert Kerr, Joshua Powell, and Sharon Meridew.
And from me to Mossy Nolan, Mark McAvoy, Ryan Williams, Michael Rakestraw, and Doug Powell.
And so, un grand merci to Michael Willis, Tom Bray, Anton Wolf, Robert Heiss, Alexander Handley, and Peter Jorgensen.
Thank you, Francois. Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Richard.